Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to Where To Go. I'm James Atkinson, Senior Brand Manager at DK Eyewitness.
And I'm Lucy Richards, Senior Editor at DK Eyewitness.
And welcome to Where To Go, where every fortnight we find out more about the world's favourite travel destinations with the people who know those places best. And today we are going somewhere a little bit different. You usually hear us going to cities, countries, etc. Mm. We are sticking in London.
Yes.
But we are really, really zoning in on the world famous Kew Gardens, officially known as the Royal Botanic Gardens. So really, really world famous. And the reason we're kind of celebrating Kew today is because Kew features heavily in DK Eyewitness's new book, Gardens of the World, which
yes.
kind of goes all around the world. It profiles 67 of the world's best gardens.
And it is beautiful, the book.
It is so, so beautiful.
Stunning. It's just gorgeous. And, you know, seeing as we've all turned so much to green spaces over the past couple of years, I think us team at DK Eyewitness, we wanted to celebrate all of the gardens of the world, all those spaces that we've all been turning to over the past couple of years. And honestly, it's just the most gorgeous book.
And the spaces we've been missing as well. I mean,
yes.
Just flick through it and it kind of really reaffirms, like, you know, our relationship with green spaces, how we, you know, how varied they can be, how, you know, from jungles to really refined French gardens to big American prairie gardens to fantastic ones in Australia. English country gardens, don't forget those. I mean, it's just diverse, it's weird, it's wonderful. So, you know, one of the most famous ones in the book, one of the ones that everyone kind of knows about is Kew. And we really wanted to, you know, like kind of speak to a garden and get that perspective. Kew's home to over 50,000 living plants, many of them endangered species. They do amazing work around the world. And it's also an incredible place to visit. And have you been, Lucy?
I have. And actually, funny enough, I went last summer on one of the hottest days of the year. So I went where I think I'd sort of slightly had enough of my local green spaces. So I met some friends at Kew Gardens and we had a picnic. And it was, you know, when you picture those perfect sort of idealized romantic summer days where the sort of like dappled sun and it's hazy and there are sort of, you know, wasps buzzing around in a pleasant way, in a horrible way. And you're having like scones and strawberries. I had that experience in Kew Gardens. It was a magical. It was beautiful. And to be honest, we didn't even make it as far as sort of the glass houses. We were too busy just chatting and basking in sunshine. And that was perfect. It was lovely.
Well, let's get ready to, you know, find out a bit more of what lies beyond it just being a lovely sunny place for a lovely sunny day. I thought I would just sort of start by looking at the intro in Gardens of the World to Kew and just reading a little bit of it. So Gardens of the World says, home to the world's most diverse collection of living plants and internationally renowned for its groundbreaking botanical research, Kew is so much more than a garden. It is a beacon that's been lighting the way in plant science for centuries. And as I say, I think that, you know, there's lots of important work at Kew that we often don't know about, but it's a place that everyone knows about. And so we're delighted to be joined by one of the a very important member of the team at Kew Gardens to dig, I'm sorry for my pun, a little bit more behind the wonderful history, the, you know, the work that kind of goes on within the gardens. So joining us live from Southwest London, where the gardens are based, is Richard Barley, Kew's Director of Gardens, who's going to take us for a deep dive into, you know, what Kew is all about for the next 40 minutes or so. So welcome, Richard.
Welcome, Richard.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for joining the podcast. It's really, really brilliant to have someone from Kew Gardens actually on the podcast. We're really, really excited.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And we're still going to talk about destination, but in a slight tweak, change to our normal format, we're going to be talking about all things Kew this afternoon, from the beautiful displays of rare plants to the urgent need for preserving biodiversity and lots in between that might surprise you. So let's get to it.
So Richard, let's start with getting to know you a bit. Tell us about your role at Kew.
Thank you. So I'm Director of Gardens at Kew, which means I have responsibility overall for all the growing bits at the Kew side, all the plants, you know, outdoors and mm-hmm. in the glasshouses, conservatories. Also our learning programs, the school programs, the volunteers, the community engagement, interpretation, garden design. School of Horticulture, importantly, where we train the next generation of horticulturists. Mm. So it's a mixture of horticulture, plant conservation and such, and also sort of more people-based activities, so particularly with the schools programs.
Yeah, because I think, something about Kew is that it is innovative and it is kind of moving on the world of like plant science in many, many ways. And I guess it's interesting you talking about the next generation there, because I think Kew has been long associated with like kind of training horticulturalists and forwarding plant science.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've been training professional horticulturists for over 100 years, but it's one of the most important things I think that we do is ensuring that there are people coming through. There is a younger generation who actually have the essential skills that are needed to understand plants in the first place, but then how to grow them. How do you get something that's, you know, possibly rare, possibly threatened with extinction? How do you sort of crack that code to work out how to grow that plant? Because you can't always just go to the manual and look it up and say, oh, that's how you grow a pea or whatever it is. Often it's a lot more difficult than that. So we train young horticulturists, we train scientists through our masters and PhDs within Kew's plant science program. And of course, importantly also, we have thousands of young children come through our schools programs every year. And to me, that's what brings the site to life. You know, you see the kids coming in, you know, two by two at the gate, and their eyes light up and their mouths drop open. And for some kids, this is the most special day of the whole year. And some of them actually say, you know, this is the best day of my life when they come in. And that is just so important and so special, because even though a place like Kew is so historical and has such layers of sort of significance, you know, UNESCO World Heritage Site and such, it is about the living world, and it's about people and plants and the interactions and fungi and the interactions and all of that. And I think that the sooner people learn that, you know, or learn some aspects of it, the better their lives will be.
Absolutely. I mean, that must be so rewarding as well to see. So you've talked about the kind of history of Kew. What about your history with Kew as well? When did you join and what were you doing before?
So I'm not quite as old as Kew. I feel it sometimes, but I came here in 2013 actually, and so I've been here almost 9 years. And I worked in Melbourne in Victoria, state of Victoria in Australia, prior to that, for about 30 years with the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne, sort of the Southern Hemisphere roughly equivalent. And then for 3 years, I was CEO of Open Gardens Australia, which is, it's the sort of Antipodean equivalent of the National Garden Scheme, so people opening their private gardens for charity, which was fascinating. It was a national role. It took me all across the length and breadth of the country and sort of, you know, meeting a lot of people in communities, sharing their garden, sharing their learning about plants. But then this opportunity came up to come over to Kew and take up this extraordinary role, which at the time was Director of Horticulture, and it has sort of evolved from that time to be Director of Gardens. So I came over here with my wife and daughter, and we've lived here at Kew since that time.
Fantastic.
How lovely.
I mean,
do you live in Kew Gardens?
We do, yeah. We live in an old cottage. It was actually originally the housekeeper's cottage for Kew Palace and the White Palace that used to be here also. So both royal residences. And so this was where the housekeeper lived. It was built about 1700, I think.
Wow. And
it's sort of just in front of Kew Palace. So our view over the kitchen sink, as it were, is of the front of the building, which is, I have to say, rather special. I mean, yes. You know, you become a little bit blasé, but then you have to remind yourself where you actually are and what your back garden actually is.
Yes, that's amazing.
That is quite incredible. And, I mean, obviously it's a huge step to come all the way from Australia to Kew, but I think that in a way almost says about the stature of Kew in and of itself. It's a globally famous, it's more than just a garden as well. It's an enormous...
A community, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it is. And certainly I, through my time at the Botanic Gardens in Melbourne, I'd always known of Kew. I'd visited here once or twice when I was able to, but it's always held in such sort of esteem. And also a lot of gardens, Melbourne, but also around the world have had long standing connections to Kew, right from the 18th century through to now. So people have come and gone, plant material has come and gone, letters by the thousands, of course, have come and gone up until email. It's sort of a path that has been trodden before. But certainly for us, it was a big decision, but one we are very excited to undertake and to load up our kit and come over here.
Fantastic.
Amazing. And I'm going to ask you a question, Richard, which I don't think you can probably answer, but what do you love most about working at Kew?
Look, it's going to be a few things, I'm afraid. It's going to be the place. and when I say place, I mean two places, because, of course, we're Kew and Wakehurst, and Wakehurst down in West Sussex is special in its own right. So the places, the plant collections are just extraordinary. I mean, we have the greatest diversity of plants on any place on the planet right here at Kew. And so anyone who likes plants or has an interest in them, this is the sort of little piece of heaven. And the people, we work with extraordinary people who, many of whom have dedicated their lives to their work, to unlocking the secrets about plants, to growing plants, to creating displays, to describing new species. You put all of that together, underlaid by a UNESCO World Heritage Site with layers of extraordinary structures and history. And, I mean, for goodness sake, Julius Caesar crossed the river here in about 52 AD to defeat the Britons. I mean, it's an amazing sort of place where stuff has happened over the centuries. And so to be in the midst of all of that, so I'm not answering your question at all because you said one thing and I've given you half a dozen.
You can have a few, that's fine.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about that. I mean, you haven't even mentioned in that the view from your kitchen window as well, which I think is probably important there.
Well, see, I associate that with doing the dishes, which might just take the gloss off
fair.
It. Yeah.
And are there any kind of, we're going to talk a bit about what makes Kew special in a second, but are there is there anything you've learned about Kew that listeners might not know or might have never have come across before?
Yeah, I'm always learning things, to be honest. I think, you only need to turn a page in a book or look under a cover or something and you find something new. So I've discovered a few things that I wasn't aware of. One is that while we generally give the date of 1759 as the establishment of Kew as a botanic garden, that's when Princess Augusta said, we will have a plant collection and, you know, it's set about being botanic garden. In fact, of course, plants had been collected here for some time before that. Her late husband, Frederick, Prince of Wales, had been gathering plants here since the 1730s. But if you go back 60, 70 years prior to that, there was a house here on site with a garden. It belonged to Sir Henry Capel, and people would travel a long distance to come and visit the garden. So so the sort of the pattern of Kew being a place to come and visit an impressive garden goes back way beyond 1759. It's probably at least another 100 years before that. So, you know, as is so often the case, there's never a particular start point, you know, when you say this is the thing, unless it's someone firing a cannon. But things often evolve over time, and that's the nature of Kew. So it's partly that. It's partly that actually Kew was two separate properties with a road up the middle with walls on either side of the road, so entirely separated. The eastern side was Princess Augusta's Botanic Garden. The western side was joined to the deer park to the south, so it was sort of pleasure ground, forest, what have you, Capability Brown and whatnot. And then it wasn't until around about 1800 that the two halves were united. The road was removed as a public road, although it still exists as an internal path. The walls were taken down and the two bits were put together, and there you have Kew as a whole piece of land, almost at the size it is now. It's now about 330 acres, but the last bit was added in the late 1800s, and that was from a gift from Queen Victoria of that bit of woodland down in the corner. So it's probably things like that. I mean, people may not know we had a hermitage with a resident hermit in it from the mid-1700s. His name was Stephen Duck, and he was a poet of not great quality as far as I can read, but he was resident there, and he used to come out and recite poetry, and his wife would sort of tidy up in the background. And he didn't have a stellar career, it has to be said, but the hermitage itself existed until, I think, the second half of the 1800s before it was finally sort of dismantled and probably turned into other things.
Wow. Yeah. I love how, like, even without his skills, Stephen Duck has lived on all of this time. I'm trying to wonder what his wife would be clearing up as well. What was he doing whilst reading that?
Well, I think he was there as the sort of the front man, you know, sort of sprouting the poetry and behaving like a hermit, and she was... if you like, being the sort of stage manager and explainer to people of, you know, what he was doing and why it was important. would have been quite a sight, I'm sure.
Fantastic. Maybe you can bring it back somehow. cool. Okay. Well, we're going to thanks for that. That's a brilliant little intro to yourself and Kew. And let's talk a little bit more about the gardens themselves. So, Richard, what would you say, and this is going to be another difficult question, what makes Kew so special, and what are some of the rare species you have on display that you can teach us about?
So why is Kew special? And I guess you need to bear in mind several things. One is we're a UNESCO World Heritage Site, so Kew has been recognised for unique qualities, you know, special values that meet the criteria for UNESCO. It's a place of great history, as I've said. It has extraordinary structures within it. You know, the Palm House alone, one of the world's most beautiful and iconic conservatories, the Temperate House, which is the largest surviving Victorian glasshouse in the world. You know, the herbarium collection, the site itself. So it's partly about that. It's certainly about the collections and the diversity of the collections, live collections, preserved collections, the science that goes on, the whole nature of how that all works together, you know, in a very sort of contemporary way. But within that, within our plant collections, we have some extraordinary things that are in some cases now extinct in the wild. And so that places a great responsibility on our horticulturists to ensure that whatever the live survivors are, that we take great care, and we seek to find ways, of course, to propagate, to grow more of them, to protect that particular species from loss. It's not always successful, I should say, because the very thing sometimes that tips a species towards the brink of extinction is because it's not easy to keep it alive, you know, or there might be a pest, a disease, or something that is specific to that plant. And sometimes that, well, often they've come from an island flora. So if you imagine an island out in the middle of the ocean, it has its flora that's evolved over millions of years. And then if you introduce goats or rats or people or what have you, very quickly the whole apple cart can be upset. You can lose whole rafts of things. And that's often what happens. So a number of the species that are of really high conservation value come from islands, isolated islands out in oceans around the world. And one, for example, is a palm that we're looking at currently. It's in the palm house. It's called Ravenia moorei. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to verify at the moment that the species we have growing may be the only surviving individual of it in the world. But we're going through a process to see whether anyone else in a botanic garden or arboretum anywhere has another one.
Wow.
And then possibly to go and say, okay, let's send a troop, let's join up with the people in the local area where the palm grows on Gran Camore Island between Madagascar and Mozambique. Go there and have a bloody good hard look for it and hopefully to find it in the wild. But at least if it's not there, then we have to be extra, extra, extra specially careful about the one we've got here, which unfortunately, of course, they have separate male and female. So they're dioecious. Ours is a male, I think. So we can't get seed because we don't have the female. There's nothing to pollinate.
Yeah.
So if we can find another one, if we can find, you know, a breeding pair, as it were, that's the start of then working towards preserving it in a greater number. But that's a really interesting one. Of course, it's in the palm house. It's about a bit over 10 metres tall.
Yeah.
One of our big projects coming up we're currently planning for is full restoration of the palm house. And to do that, we need to move everything out. And so you can imagine a 10-metre tall palm, which is possibly the last surviving example in the world, we're going to have to be really, really, really careful in what we do with that palm, that we don't do things to jeopardise its survival. I mean, lifting it out on its own is then starts to become a little risky. So these are all things we have to weigh up. At the other end of the scale, of course, we have something like the dwarf water lily, that Nymphaea thermarum, that only grew in the wild at the edge of one hot spring in Rwanda in Central Africa. And then about 10 years ago, one of the local village people diverted the water out of the hot spring and the water level dropped and the wild population died out. But fortunately, we had a small population of the plants here at Kew, because we'd been sent seed from a German botanist in this case. They'd collected the seed. They'd had difficulty growing the plant back home in Germany. They sent some over to Kew. Some of our horticultural staff here, Carlos Magdalena was the main person, worked out the combination of factors you needed to work with to get the plant to germinate and then to keep growing. So we have collections of that plant here. It's extinct in the wild now, but we've shared it with other botanic gardens just to ensure, again, it's about survival of the species into the future.
Yeah. How do you even go around? I mean, that in of itself just shows the network of Kew, the fact that you can get a German botanist going to find something in Rwanda that then you can ultimately help to save that plant as well. That's pretty
well, it's interesting with botanic gardens. I'm sure it's probably it certainly is the same with zoos, of course. We have a very strong network around the world. There's a lot of collaboration, a lot of exchange of ideas, and exchange of plant material, because we can share material for the purposes of conservation to grow them, sometimes in more suitable conditions than we have here at Kew. You know, we can send a tropical plant to the tropics, for example. And that helps to ensure the protection of those plants in the longer term. That's as contrasted to people who go and collect plants illegally from wild populations and then sell them on the internet in ways that are usually illegal. So you have that sort of trade going on, which often puts a plant at jeopardy in terms of survival because they're over-harvested and sold around the world.
Mm. Yeah.
But we are able to do it in a way that protects the plant, that is for the longer term good, and share the knowledge and educate people about the plants as well.
It's really fascinating. It's really, really encouraging to hear about that good work as well.
Yes. So, Richard, obviously, I think when people think of Kew Gardens, they think of it as being a tourist attraction. You've obviously hit on all of the hard work that's going on behind the scenes. But can you tell us a bit more? What I'd like to hear about is you've got the biggest archive of botanical information in the world, which I think people don't necessarily realise, sort of as you've hit on, how much research you hold and how much training you're holding. Can you tell us a bit about what can be found in that collection and specifically how it's used?
Sure. So Kew is a place of collections. I've spoken a bit about the live plants. The preserved plant collections, which are held in the herbarium, there's somewhere between 7 and 8 million specimens in that collection, many of which are actually the original type specimens, which means that when the plant was first described and given a name, that was the specimen that was used as the basis for the description, for the scientist to describe all the details of the plant, you know, all its parts, all its measurements, and say, and we'll call this plant Acacia alpha, whatever it might be. So that's the type, and they're very special ones. So we have a lot of those in the herbarium, and as I said, around 7.5 or so million specimens. So it's one of the world's larger herbaria. There's also a huge botanical library full of all manner of books, old, ancient, and also modern. A huge collection of botanical artwork from you know, again, dating back several hundred years, but also with a lot of contemporary work, journals, documents, letters, you know, all manner of archives in there, hundreds of thousands of pieces. We have a DNA collection. We have, again, world's largest, I think, fungarium, so a collection of fungi specimens, bearing in mind that you know, we think we probably know somewhere around maybe 90% of the world's vascular flora, the plants, you know, the flowering plants and conifers and so forth, and we probably think we know somewhere under 10% of the world's fungi flora. So there's a huge realm of fungi out there that we actually have no idea about yet. So that's a big area of growth. Fungi, wood slide collection. There's a, you know, the collections go on and on, but those are probably the main ones. And one of the things about it, you mentioned that people, you know, understandably don't know all that's there because a lot of it is behind walls, behind doors.
Yeah.
It's not on public display. But one of our big projects that we're moving into, planning and moving into over the coming 12 months, is to digitise all the herbarium specimens so that they will be publicly accessible through the internet, digitised specimens with all the metadata, all the transcribed information that went on the original collector's label with that plant. So that will make the use of the collection, the value of the collection to people around the world sort of magnify many, many times, because instead of, you know, I guess previously if you were a botanist who had a particular interest in a group of plants, you would pack your bag, jump on a ship or an aeroplane, come to Kew, go to the herbarium, open those cupboards, pull out those specimens and have a look at them. Anyone around the world will be able to just log on and look at the digitised images. So there's a huge benefit to that. It's a partly government-funded project, and that should be completed over the coming 3 years. We're really excited about that.
It's also worth saying, unfortunately, listeners can't see this, but Richard, you're sitting in front of what looks like a gorgeous bookshelf of old, beautiful books.
So I'm going to just pull one out here. So these are the bound copies, I mean, amongst other things in the office, but these are bound copies of the Gardener's Chronicle, which was it was the weekly horticultural journal stretching from the 1800s. In fact, the modern version is Horticulture Week, which is this.
Yes, of course,
so it is the same.
Amazing.
And you know, I quite like old things, and I saved these from probably finding their way into a skip at some point. But recently I had to try and find some information about one person, and the only place I could find it was in the old Gardener's Amazing. Chronicles up behind me. So they do have a use still. And, of course, once you've looked up that thing, there's all the other stuff in there, which is fascinating reading, I must say.
Fall down rabbit holes, I'm sure.
Many rabbit holes.
Absolutely. And I love the idea that there's kind of, you know, almost all the history of what we know about flora and fauna, et cetera, is there in Kew. That, and the fact that you're bringing that to the world as well is super exciting with the digitization scheme. And I wanted to kind of talk a bit about some of the scientific work that you guys do as well, because we've talked about kind of protecting some species, but you also are world leaders in kind of plant science and research as well. And you know, we've actually got a new book called Gardens of the World out. Kew is extensively featured. I think it might be the longest extract in there. And we've actually put it into our, we have different sections, and we've called Kew a sort of innovator and an influencer, because even though Kew has all of the history, it's that kind of inspiration of, like, you know, of some of the work that you guys do, and particularly that kind of scientific element as well, that I think really kind of has moved on, you know, not just like what it is to be a garden, but, you know, how we study plants, how we understand them across the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. There's a couple of important things there. One is that, you know, it, as an historical place, it doesn't mean that we don't go around wearing period costume and you know, riding a horse. You know, gardens evolve, landscapes evolve, practices evolve, and issues evolve. So having that history of, you know, over 250, 260 years of endeavour gives us the credibility and reputation to do what we do now around the world. So Kew works, you know, our scientists work with something around 130 partners around the world on a huge variety of projects, through the Millennium Seed Bank, collecting seed, looking at food security in different countries and things like that. So it's a very global partnership relationship project, and it has become ever more so over recent decades. That's probably the shift from, you know, the most significant shift from the Kew of the 19th century, say, early 20th century, where, you know, Kew was here as part of the broader Commonwealth of Britain and you know, getting plants from other countries and finding ways to get economic benefits. So it's a far more outward-looking, genuinely a collaborative and partnership approach taken around the world. And we have over 300 scientists working both here and internationally. So genuine, you know, projects that actually deliver a huge amount of potential benefit, you know, looking for potential nature-based solutions to climate issues, looking at sustainability of future crops and things like that. One of the recent really interesting stories was around coffee. We have one or two people who've worked extensively on coffee over a number of years. Aaron Davies is the key person. And he was following up an old report of a species that was last spotted in the mid-1950s called Coffea stenophylla, which was reputed to have a better flavour than Arabica or Robusta, but it was thought to have gone extinct. But he set off with some local partners in Sierra Leone into the mountains, and they actually found, well, initially found one plant, but then they moved over a couple of ranges and they found quite a good population of that plant, which gives such huge potential for the future, because it's more drought tolerant than Arabica or Robusta, and apparently it has you know, resilience to higher temperatures. So the coffee crops in some areas are under quite a lot of threat from rising temperatures and lower rainfall, but a plant like that can hold huge potential for the future. And of course, the coffee economically around the world, I think it's the second most valuable commodity on world markets. So it affects literally tens and tens of millions of people in terms of their livelihood. So that sort of work is really interesting.
That's really fascinating. I mean, I knew that about coffee because it's come up in a pub quiz before, I think, weirdly. But like, but I mean, actually, have you actually tried any of the coffee that was discovered in Sierra Leone yet?
No, I haven't, and that's a very good point. Actually, I need to order one up.
Put in an order right away. That's yeah. Pressing matters for sure. But yeah, it's brilliant to hear a little bit about the impact that Q kind of has on the world as well. And we're going to talk in the next section just a little bit about kind of the Q over the past couple of years, and you know what visitors can look forward to as well coming up.
Ready for a next green adventure? DCare Witness's all-new book, Gardens of the World, is the ultimate guide to the world's best gardens and green spaces, profiling 67 destination gardens that tell a unique story and have been instrumental in the history of design or reinvent what a garden means.
Compiled by expert garden writers and green-fingered enthusiasts, each garden is brought to life through stunning photography and immersive descriptions, exploring the incredible stories, people and plantings behind them, while horticultural tips inspire you to recreate their iconic styles at home. Find the book in all good bookshops or through the link in our episode bio.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So tell us, how has the pandemic impacted Kew and more widely botanic gardens across the world?
So during the COVID pandemic, I mean, like everyone's been affected by it. No one has been immune. We were closed for 10 weeks from late March or mid-March, I think it was, until early June in 2020. I don't think we'd ever been closed for that long in our entire history. It was a great pity. I mean, we could see people sort of standing at the gates wanting to come in, and luckily when we were able to reopen under the government's guidelines, people flooded back in. And the thing that really came through, and I think it's not just us, more broadly in terms of public gardens and parks across the country and around the world, is how people felt that they needed that connection with nature and the value that actually gardens like this provide, just in being a sanctuary and being a place to restore people's spirits and just sort of, you know, be with nature. I think, you know, we'd known that that was important and we'd known that it was valuable, but actually it sort of was boosted tenfold when we saw the physical evidence of how much people cared about it. So that for us was a real, well, it was sort of both uplifting and quite emotional to see that you know, we had such a strong place in people's hearts in the community. We know people love coming in here. We know generation to generation they'll come in. I love those stories where, you know, grandpa used to bring the kids in and then the kids bring their kids in. So you have that sort of linkage across time. So we obviously during the COVID lockdown period and all of that, we kept working here because we need to keep the plants alive.
I was going to say, like, obviously you can't just stop with all the work that you've just talked about at all.
Yeah, so I mean, some of our lawns got a little bit hairy. It wasn't being mown quite as often as it sometimes is. Some of our staff got a bit hairy as well. But you know, we did the important things, and the most important thing was caring for the living collections and also for the other assets around the site to make sure that things didn't suffer damage through neglect. And then when we were able to reopen, while we mightn't have quite been to our normal standards in terms of overall horticultural presentation, at least we had the essence of it well covered, and then we're able to gradually work our way back up from there. I mean, obviously everyone, both at Kew and more broadly around the world, you know, have been affected personally often, you know, with losses of relatives and family members. So, you know, we share everyone's sort of concern and you know, we are part of a community that has actually suffered a lot. So,
absolutely.
So, but again, having a place for people to come to reconnect, to join up, to get back on track has been really, really important. And in terms of visitation now, I mean, the year prior to lockdown was our busiest on record. We had close to 2.4 million visits that year. We're pretty much back up to around 2 million at the moment. So,
great.
So we are sort of coming back pretty strongly just currently. And I think what's missing at the moment is the full strength of international tourism.
Absolutely.
You know, there's a percentage of that, but it's nowhere near the usual amount. And people who know far better than I do say it'll be another couple of years probably, if all goes well, before that returns full strength.
I mean, fingers crossed. Certainly one thing that many people have commented on the pandemic, and you've sort of alluded to there, is people kind of, placing this extra emphasis on green spaces and becoming, like, you know, reintroducing themselves to nature. And I think, you know, it's almost like spending time indoors has made you more and more curious about the outside world and actually, you know, not realizing what you've got until it's gone, all of that stuff, which, you know, there are very few silver linings to the pandemic, but you could almost say that, you know, people coming back in their droves and really kind of, you know, embracing outdoor spaces is maybe one of them.
Yeah. I mean, I think it, you know, with anything like that, you reassess what's important. And you, when you don't have the opportunity to do something, it suddenly becomes very clear what it is you really, really want to do. And sometimes it is just to go out and sit under a tree or what have you. And also a lot of people who previously weren't necessarily endowed with great green thumbs, they became gardeners of one sort or another, you know, collections of indoor plants or in the, you know, window ledges, whatever. Growing plants has really become more and more popular over the last few years, which again is fabulous, particularly as often it's younger people.
Yes.
So it's you know, it's almost a thing, isn't it, to have a fabulous collection of indoor plants now. Yes. And I've seen some great examples of houses, apartments that are almost like a jungle inside, which is great. I mean, wow, what a incredible.
I think my flat is reaching that stage. I'm not sure my boyfriend's best pleased.
Yeah, I think you've got, like, not just lockdown gardeners, but people who've really kind of, you know, tried to, you know, you've got your banana bread bakers, your amateur cooks, your, you know, the people who've written novels, etc. And gardening is creativity, and it's a way of exploring the natural world that you can do at home as well. And
yeah, absolutely. And we know, I mean, through the work here at the School of Horticulture and more widely, we get a lot of people who set out on a career, you know, the thing that they thought was the right thing to do. They've studied law, they've, you know, become a financial wizard, whatever it is. But they get to a point 10, 15 years down the track and they think, hang on a minute, you know, okay, this just isn't what I thought it was, and I really don't enjoy it. I don't feel sort of spiritually enriched by doing this. And then they look across and they see horticulture and growing plants and getting your hands in the soil and understanding the biology of things, and we get a lot of people sort of swapping careers and coming into horticulture at that point. We've had some people with amazing backgrounds and first careers who then just decided it's not for them. And as I always say, all roads lead to horticulture in the end. So
fantastic. Well, if you're listening to this and you think, maybe I need a change, then some wise words, great courses.
Yeah.
So for, you know, going back to those kind of travellers who actually do want to visit Kew, and let's hope those visitor numbers get past those 2019 levels, when would be the best time to visit? What's going on at Kew over the next year?
Well, I mean, As is the case often with guns, people say, what's the best time? And I always say, this week. I mean, really, because every week is different. You know, yeah. Even in the midst of winter, it's a really sort of evocative and interesting landscape when you see the bones and the shapes of the trees against sort of dull grey skies. I'd rather see that than buildings against dull grey skies.
Absolutely.
Any time of year, but... we are, of course, now coming into the height of spring and then going into summer. So that's a great time to be in any garden. And here at Kew, we have sort of festivals, if you like, themed festivals. And the one that's kicking off at the end of May this year is under the heading of Food Forever. So it's a festival that's entirely themed around the sort of the nature of food in the world and the fairly fragile state of some of the food supply. Issues. So you know, the billions of people who rely on a comparatively small number of food crops as compared to the huge potential of the plants that exist in the wild that could be tapped into to you know, even things up to create alternatives to ensure that people are properly fed into the future. So the festival has artistic installations around the site, it has exhibition aspects. It has a talk and demonstration project. There's a cookbook that's been launched, I think, in June, the Kew Gardens cookbook, which is full of vegetarian recipes from celebrity chefs of one sort or another. So there's a whole lot of stuff going on around that program from end of May through to late September. And then at that point we kick across into the what will be a festival themed around Mexican culture. So our autumn festival this year. Last year it was Japan. This year it will be Mexico. So there'll be a month of again, Mexican culture, food, music, plants, maybe a little hint of Day of the Dead, I'm not sure. And then, of course, you get into Christmas again and before we know it, we're back at this time of year because the year just whips by before you can blink. So there's always a few things going on the site. You know, there's always the gardens, there's always the glass houses, always the things, you know, day by day to come and visit. And then there's the other activities, the visitor sort of events and festivals and so forth.
Both of those activities sound amazing. And I know in Mexico you've got quite famous gardens like Las Posas and others, but like that region of Central America is so biodiverse and has, you know, kind of, I don't know, like, is it a certain percentage of the world's, like, flora and fauna?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, hugely diverse. It was the Edward James Garden, wasn't it, Las Poggias?
Yes, yeah.
So we've had some discussions over time, I know, with them about they're wishing to restore some of the garden to its former glory. So yes, again, partnerships around the world, sharing expertise, you know, providing the benefits of our understanding of things where it's helpful. Absolutely, that will continue.
Fantastic.
I have one final question. Richard, do you have like a favourite season at Kew Gardens, or does every season bring its own magic?
Well, look, to be perfectly honest, I come from a warmer place.
And, of course, yes.
And a day like today is almost getting up to my operating temperature. And sadly, in a whole year, it happens about twice. So for me, hot weather, whenever it occurs, I feel so much better. And of course, where better than to be in a garden on a hot day? And then if you really want to add a bit of temperature on that, you go into one of the tropical glass houses, the palm house, the water lily house, to really push the humidity up and start sweating a bit. But frankly, as I said, year round, because because it changes so much. You know, you get a completely different feel. You know, the things relax in autumn, the leaves are blowing around. It's a completely different feel from that sort of very showy sort of spring, early summer period. Mm. So I guess it's that. I guess I like summer. Yeah.
I'm going to ask one more final question, and it's slightly unscripted. So don't, and you're obviously here to talk about Kew, so don't worry if you don't want to answer it. But obviously this is a travel podcast and it sounds like you've worked with, been to so many gardens around the world. Is there kind of one favourite that isn't Kew, obviously? I know you're kind of like bound to it, or maybe Melbourne, that you would love to visit tomorrow?
So ones I've been to that were fabulous experiences, I'd probably just mention, well, there's a whole lot, aren't there? But you know, Gardens by the Bay in Singapore.
Yes.
Have you
yes.
been there?
I've never been there. I really want to go. No, I mean, it just looks incredible. Looks all of amazing. The pictures of it.
Extraordinarily ambitious, completely over the top. You know, just amazing project which achieved what it set out to achieve. It's just, you know, it's almost mind blowing in its sort of in its scope and what they've done. So that's I've been there. I was there when it was being built, and I went back after it was finished. But I'd certainly go back there in a heartbeat. And also, you know, I've sort of ruled a line through Melbourne because I'm not allowed to nominate my home place. But actually, that's one of the nicest botanic gardens in the world. In fact, Arthur Conan Doyle said when he was sitting in the botanic gardens in Melbourne, this is the most beautiful place in the entire world. So, you know, it's pretty good. But what I was going to say
is... Quite a wise man.
By the way, the sister garden to that garden is one down at Cranbourne, and that's where a landscape called the Australian Garden was developed. And it's a very contemporary interpretation of Australian landscape and culture, and that is one I'd really recommend that people take the time to go to if they're visiting Australia, because it's unlike anything else they'll ever see. And of course, here in good old UK, you know, there are so many good gardens there. Mm. You know, not only places like our own, the RHS and others, there's all those private gardens opened by the National Garden Scheme. You know, extraordinary, beautiful gardens up and down the length and breadth of the country, open every weekend. There's a selection open. So, you know, there you get the personal sort of gardening tastes and flavours and sort of quirks that you don't necessarily find in a big public estate. And, of course, Wakehurst down in Sussex, I'd be a fool to not mention them. It is such a beautiful place, and they're doing some really, really interesting contemporary horticulture there. Their American Prairie Garden is certainly worth a visit at the moment.
Wow.
Well, loads of great recommends there.
That was, it was really, really concise and brilliant and a real advert for kind of garden travel as well, and getting out there and seeing and spending a weekend, especially, you know, it's brightening up now. Great time.
Well, one of the things, just on garden travel, I mean, you may or may not know that garden-based tourism brings into this country a huge amount of wealth. And I think it's broadly not recognised, it's underestimated, but it is worth a lot to this country. The reasons people come to visit the UK and how many of them come here with their main activity is visiting gardens. And I think the more people who know that, maybe the more then we value and respect the things that we have in front of us.
Absolutely. No, I think, as I say, we've got this new book all about kind of gardens of the world, but the UK ones are spectacular. There's, you know, obviously yourselves, but then, you know, from the Eden Project in the west, Sissinghurst in the east, and then Garden of Cosmic Speculation in Scotland, which is a fantastic small one. You know, there's so much to see. So, yeah, what better inspiration really to get out there and do it than to hear it from yourself, Richard. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
And we won't take up any more of your valuable time going back to all of the many projects that you're working on. But just to say thank you so much for joining us. It's been lovely talking to you. And, you know, really, hopefully it's inspired all of our visitors to, you know, get on the internet, plan their visit to Kew, and get it in the diary, because I certainly, for one, will.
Yeah, we'll be there, Richard.
Yeah. We'll see you there. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the chat. Yeah, cheerio then. Thank you.
Well, a huge, huge thank you to Richard for taking us to Kew Gardens and telling us all the things that they're working on. I really, really enjoyed that. I genuinely didn't want to stop talking to him.
I mean, it was a massive, massive honour. And I know you're quite green-fingered, Lucy.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just it's just inspirational to hear about all the work that they do.
Yeah.
About it, you know, it as a location, as somewhere you can go visit and experience, but kind of its impact all around the world. I thought it was really, really inspiring, and thank you so much to Richard and the team at Kew for setting that up. That was brilliant.
A huge thank you. And if you want to learn more about Kew and the work they're doing, you can visit their website www.kew.org, or you can follow them on Instagram at Kew Gardens.
And so we are back with a normal schedule next time, where normal services resuming. We're back on our cities and we are going to the wonderful foodie heaven. You know, we know our listeners love their food.
Yes.
We love our food.
Yes.
Of Lyon with Anna Richards, yeah. who lives there and is taking us around that sort of the French capital of gastronomy, really. So we will very much look forward to that. We will very much look forward to seeing you then, listener. And it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
And we shall see you very soon.
Where to Go was produced by the team at DK Witness and the wonderful Julia Baker. It was presented by James Atkinson and Lucy Richards and mastered by Johnny Coddington at Bottle Rocket Recording. For more information about DK Witness, follow us on social media at DK Eyewitness or visit dk.com/eyewitness.
And don't forget to please like, rate, review and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Your support means so much to us.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.